Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So tonight being the kind of first Saturday night, first One Pra, kind of first occasion that Ajahn Pasno, Lumpur Pasno, could give a Dhamma talk since he's been back. And I'm sure we're all excited to hear about his trip to Thailand and hear all of his wonderful wisdom. And he asked me to give the Dhamma talk, so thank you, Lumpur. And I also got like 2 hours notice too, so that was nice. A lot of people don't know this about Lumpur, but he came up to me right after we came down from the Patimokkha and got out of the vehicle and came up to me and said, "Do you mind if could you give the Dhamma talk, you know, tonight?" And I was like, "What? Are you serious?" And people probably don't know this, but he has these really sad puppy dog eyes. And he kind of looked at me, had his head kind of turned sideways, like, "I'm really tired, I'm really out of it." And I was like, "How can I say no?" And I think my response was kind of incredulous, like, "Are you kidding?" He said, "Please." So I was thinking about it. I actually have said no to, I think Ajahn Siddhanta's asked me to give Dhamma talks before at the Hermitage, and just nothing was there, and said no. I've said no to Ajahn Punadamo. I've said no to Ajahn Yatiko when he was here. So it's kind of hard to say no to Lumpur, though, because as we know, he gives so much, and I particularly demand a lot of him, and he's very generous with me, so it's kind of hard to, when Lumpur asked, to say no. But I did ask him, I said, "Can I give like the shortest Dhamma talk ever given?" And he said, "Yes." He said, "It's going to be, people have been busy today, and they're going to be busy tomorrow, so that would be appropriate." So I've given Gambiro the permission, if 15 minutes passes, to let me know, so I probably won't go that short, but who knows. What has come up into my mind, though, just in the last 2 hours, was some of the readings we've had during the last couple of weeks, and also too at the end of this afternoon, one of the monks chanted all of the monks' rules, and then Lumpur does give a short reflection at the end of that usually, and just mentioned that we're 3 weeks into the retreat now, and it's only a 12-week period, and it is this retreat is kind of the highlight for all of us for the entire year. And, here it is, it's a quarter of it's already gone. And so, kind of thinking about it in terms of, before we started the retreat, we all had expectations, we all had sort of hopes of what we might want to focus on during the retreat. So maybe some special practices or just some determinations that we wanted to do. And, here the retreat's a quarter over, so it's a really good opportunity to reflect on that. Like, what were your expectations? And how are you doing with that? You might be doing great. It's the attendance at all of the sittings has been spectacular. I think I've noticed the last couple of, this last week where, I don't think I've ever seen this happen before to Bhagiri, where everybody who's living here has actually like been in the hall during the morning meditation. It's like I think it just shows that as a community we're really settling down and enjoying practicing together. And when we were doing the afternoon practices together, I think there were certain many numbers of days that like even the entire retreat crew were here. All seven of you were here. So it's just so many ways it's like, yeah, compliments, we seem to be doing really well. It's probably the quietest retreat I've been part of in all the years that I've been here. Just not many conversations happening in the spare time, or if there are, people are being really polite and you know, choosing their place to do that. I'm sure there is some talking, but it's really quite reasonable. But just look at what expectations you had. Did you have an idea of getting up earlier in the morning and doing some sutta readings, or doing more chanting, or taking on a particular meditation, and have you done that? Ajahn Jeff once talked about making determinations. He was talking to me about this, and he said a lot of times people will make a determination for the rains retreat to not say have desserts, and then as soon as they break that for some reason, then they I've broken it. Okay, I'm just going to throw that away. I'm just not going to follow that anymore. I've already broken it, so it's not worth it. He's like, no, just use that as an opportunity to learn, just to see. Okay, yeah, I've broken that, but just to recommit to it. So if it was a particular practice you wanted to take on that you think had some value to it, to you, to do it, just reconsider putting forth the effort into doing that. If you found that your meditation is going really, really well, and you don't need to take on that extra determination, that's fine as well. But just look at those earlier expectations and see how you're doing. Myself, I really wanted to. I've been avoiding for the last 6 months or so. One of the monks at Wat Metta asked if I would read through a new manuscript for a Vinaya manual, and it was something I wanted to do, but also too just not having time, or so there was aversion towards it as well, wanting to do it but also having aversion. So I decided, I kind of committed to him that I would look at it during the winter retreat, and just this week I kind of realized about that point 2 weeks had passed by and I hadn't even touched it. I was like, it's not going to get done if I don't pick it up. And so I just made a determination to start doing that this week. And so, and I'm actually enjoying it during the downtime, just having the periods of around breakfast or after the meal or during the evening tea time when we're not formally doing meditation, of just taking that opportunity to do that. I kind of got sidetracked at the beginning because I saw several of the community members were doing crocheting during those down periods, and I used to love crocheting when I was younger, about 10 years ago. I used to crochet all the time, and when I had an illness after I did my long walk in Mississippi for 3 or 4 years, I was really extremely low energy. And I was actually, at the time, I was living in the duplex, and the energy was so low that I could sit in meditation and lotus posture, but doing walking meditation was just didn't have the energy for that. So I would do an hour sitting, then I'd do an hour crocheting, do an hour sitting, and an hour crocheting, and I think I crocheted my bowl cover and Ajahn Kirunadamo's bowl cover and one other bowl cover at the time. During that period. And so we had a reading just this week, I think it was Limpur Sumedho, was talking about having, that project of doing a bowl stand and kind of, trying to rush to get it done before the retreat started, and then, just kind of setting it on a shrine as this unfinished project. And I was reflecting, the year that I spent in Thailand, I could see that would be a, really wise thing to do, to, if you have these projects or something kind of like a building project or making something, that that would be something you would want to kind of set aside and just part of the climate there. It's like, it's actually, the weather's kind of conducive to to be outside, to be meditating, to doing walking meditation. But here it's like, we're in a slightly different climate, different environment, and as soon as the sun goes down, it does get really cold and can be windy, and it's not so, great to be outdoors. And especially when we're doing practice where we're all together, it's like, if you don't really have, much going on, there can be the tendency to want to talk, to socialize, to get engaged in some way. So in the early days here, we always were still in the house. The Dhamma hall wasn't really used for that, or maybe we did, but Ajahn Amaro would, for tea time, would be sitting up here in the front, and he would just pull out his socks and start darning. And people were watching this, and he taught us all how to darn socks. And so that was a big thing at tea time. We, in the early days too, like tea time used to be, wasn't so informal, where if you wanted tea, you had to actually come into either the house or the Dhamma hall wherever we were having it. And it would be like on the one prowls at the midnight, where the tea trays were made up and passed down, and you got two cups, and there'd be the tea tray was passed down twice, and so everybody would be in the hall having their tea, and most of us would be darning socks or maybe studying the chanting, but we'd all be sitting there doing that. So kind of learned that I always felt that as a meditation technique. Just using the time skillfully to be looking after our requisites as a way of trying not to engage with other people and respecting other people's silence. So when I heard Lumpur Sumeo say that, I was like, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Putting aside projects, especially here, there's so many projects that we can get involved in, and sort of improving the monastery. And you can think of, I can think of, dozens and dozens of projects that, that are probably ideal to be doing during the winter time, but it's really good to set those aside. But these kind of projects, are taking on something like, crocheting or darning socks or looking after our requisites, I think these can be really skillful applications of our energy and of our time. Like crocheting in particular can actually be a really concentrative type of practice, especially if you're trying to do something like a bowl cover or anything that has like a shape or a pattern to it. Because you have to keep, especially when you're doing like a bowl cover, as you're going doing the cover, you have to add stitches if you're trying to, it's getting larger and larger. And there's like a certain number of stitches that you have to increase you're basically doing it in a circle, and you have to add, it's like, I think it's like 7 or 8, depends on how big your stitches are and things like that. But as you're going along, it's like, you say every round you're adding 7. So like as you're going along, it's like you might be at 70 stitches. So you have to count 10. And you add 1, and then you count 10 more, and you add 1. And so it's like, count 10, 1, 20, 1, 30, 1. So you count around, so you count to 70, and you've added 1. So the next time you have to, on the 11s, and you have to add it. And you count to 11 7 times, and it's 12 7 times. And so you have to be really mindful, like, where am I? Where am I in that stitching? So it can keep you, present. You also have to be very mindful of, the motion of the crochet needle, and making sure that you're, doing the stitch correctly, and it looks good. And there's many ways that you can mess up. So it can be this real beautiful way of, staying connected, physically with your body, with your hands, with your posture. But keeping the mind focused on just this one little action of just one little motion of crocheting and knowing where you are. Another thing I was kind of contemplating was of the two determinations that I really wanted to focus on for the retreat for myself was the minor one was the looking at the Vinaya text, but the other one was just much more mindfulness of the body, so when dealing with an injury and focusing on a lot of stretching. So it's almost still hesitant to be doing very much walking meditation at all. And so whenever like I was that year when I was really sick. You say sitting for an hour, crocheting for an hour. What I'm doing this retreat is, you know, meditating for the meditation period in here formally. But then when I would normally be walking meditation, I'm in the Tara's vestry over here doing stretching. So getting in, you know, 4 or 5 sessions a day of stretching. So really, really paying attention to the body and kind of experiencing what it's like to actually have hips that actually move a little bit and have a little bit of flexibility. And so paying attention to just the body posture in general. And when I first started the retreat, sitting on a bench, I've never sat on a bench, a stool kind of bench like this, and it was extremely painful for the first couple of weeks. I was actually kind of surprised. I was kind of envied the monks that got to sit on the benches, and I don't anymore. And during that period of time, I was doing a lot more standing meditation as well, and kind of realized that you've received very little standing meditation instructions since I've been meditating. The only place that I've ever been that really stressed it was Steve and Rosemary Wiseman, this couple in southern Thailand that do a retreat. And I mentioned that the last time, I think the last talk I gave, where you know, the guy standing next to me fell asleep during the very first time we did it and cracked his head really hard. But after giving that talk, I've been doing a lot more kind of standing meditation as well. And I have, after kind of talking about it, I did notice that I was trying to see if there was any even much writing about it. One place that there is some, I think, some pretty good instructions on it is Adzen Shichito's book, Meditation. It's a spiral-bound book. I didn't see it in our library, but it is in the free distribution. There was a book there. But there's some, if you're interested in developing that as a formal meditation, there's some really good instructions there. And one thing I've noticed, though, is kind of general instructions on that is that just to be standing with your kind of feet about shoulder-width apart, and then just really trying to keep your body loose. And so it's paying attention to the your hips in particular, trying to keep them loose and not locking your knees and your hips. So there can be a tendency, like if we've never really paid attention to how we stand, I've noticed this, it's like if I'm in the bowl area, say at breakfast time, and making a cup of tea or doing something, there's a tendency to kind of lean into the counter and actually like trying to have the weight of your body, trying to transfer it onto to some other object instead of allowing the body to do that. And when you kind of lean into something, it's like you might kind of tense up your hips to do that. And so it's almost like your upper part of your body and your hips are trying to take the majority of the weight, whereas when you stand, it's like, okay, then you're completely free standing. You're not leaning on anything. You can see that the tensing of the knees, the tensing of the hips, tensing of even the back and the shoulders, is this way of trying to hold the weight. So it's just really learning to relax those various parts of our body, and the better we can get our posture. One thing Ajahn Sucitto really suggests is to kind of imagine like if you had a tail, that you're kind of tucking your tail between your legs, so kind of moving your hips in that kind of direction. And one thing I really noticed was if I just moving your knees just slightly out, so they're more kind of really directly over your feet instead of kind of more inward, it creates this really kind of, for me, like this kind of power triangle. Like I can really feel when I do that, the feet get really kind of pressed into the ground. Ajahn Sucitto talks about it, like even kind of imagining that you're taking root into the earth, like really imagining you're not standing on the earth, but you're actually part of the earth. Sometimes just having that mental image just gives you this kind of solidity, and you can kind of feel the energy, you know, flowing from the bottoms of your feet, you know, up through your body. But what I noticed when I just slightly move the knees out, you know, it just creates, I feel like this really, like say a power triangle that can feel the energy going between the 2 feet and up to the spine, and then if the spine is in a good posture and you're not leaning too far forward or too far backwards, it can almost become not necessarily effortless, but you feel the energy flowing from the earth kind of up through your body, and it can be very energizing and kind of freeing. And with the practice, it's what I kind of like about the standing meditation is that you have to continually be aware. So it's not like you just sort of put yourself in the right posture, and then all of a sudden you can just sort of, you know, start contemplating what's going on in the mind and not deal with the body, you know, because the body's constantly adjusting, making subtle adjustments just to be balanced. And so you have to continually bring your attention back, and just habitually if we do hold the tension in our hips, or our knees are locked up, you know, there's this continually, you have to come back to the body to relax it, to let the tension to go, to soften the body. And Ajahn Sucitto points out that with standing meditation, it is one of the difficulties with it, or, you know, one of the hindrances of doing that particular type of meditation, is that it does bring up a lot of tension. It does bring up a lot of dealing with tension, dealing with stress is one of the main things that you learn by doing standing meditation. And so I'd say, like, if you have a tendency to notice that you, during, like, say, sitting meditation, you know, drifting off to just going into fantasy, or to when you come out of when the bell rings the meditation and you're not really clear, you know, standing meditation can be a really good, I think, you know, bringing you back into your body, really, you know, making you, you know, look at that, the, you know, how we deal with stress, how we deal with tension, because it's really easy when you're standing to feel the tension and to really want to work with it, really want to overcome the stress. And, you know, then I think, you know, in the reading I did the other day was Ajahn Nyanadamo's walking meditation. You know, it's the same thing, like, you know, what we learn from the walking meditation, the, you know, the concentration that can come from that particular, either one of those, standing or walking meditation, that it's can be a really, even say, more powerful of a concentration than you get from sitting. You know, so once you've developed the concentration from that, it's easier to take that kind of concentration back into sitting meditation. And one thing Ajahn Nyanadamo didn't say in his talk, which I've always thought about with walking meditation, and I can see this with standing as well, is that you constantly have to be, you know, there's more opportunities to come back to the present moment when you're doing, especially, let's say, like walking meditation. You can just get into a fantasy or a planning project, and you know, the entire period can go and you weren't present at all, which is, you know, as we all know, is very easy to do in sitting meditation. But with walking meditation, there's so many more opportunities to come back to your body, because, like, you know, every single time you come to the end of your walking path, you can just say, you know, when you turn around and just before you start walking, just to make that determination, okay, I will just be with the physical sensations, you know, of the feet on the ground between here and the end of my walking path, or to be aware of the breath, or to be aware of if you're using a mantra while you're walking, and just, okay, from here to there, all I want to do is just be aware of the sensations of the feet. And really, you know, put your full effort into that. You know, and that's all you have to, and just give yourself permission just to do that, just from point A to point B, just be aware of the feet. That's all you have to do. And then you get to the end of the walking path and then make the determination and be mindful of the turning around. And then you can stop and just start, just stay that all over again, just between this point and point B back to point A, just be aware of the feet. And really talk to yourself this way too until it becomes a habit, until it is ingrained and fun to do. And then just make that real strong determination in your mind. Okay, walk from point B to point A, just being aware of the feet. And you walk back. And I've heard some instructions too of, you just like, you know, once you can easily do that, you know, from point A to point B, with just being with the feet, you make a, it's kind of like a counting of the breath. You can do the same thing, like, okay, can I walk, you know, back and forth 10 times without, or maybe start off with five times back and forth, and then do 6 times back and forth, and then up to 10, and then back down to 5. And doing that can, you know, really, really strengthen the mind. The other type of meditation that we don't talk about too much is lying down meditation. And also Ajahn Sucitto, it's very short. And in his book, he basically kind of just goes through in minute detail the, you know, exactly how to hold the body and in the posture. The main one that that we do is called the lion's posture. And so it's lying down on the right side, and basically, you know, you have your hand up kind of underneath your head, kind of almost using it as a pillow, and then having your body be in a straight. So it's like we're not sort of curling up into the fetal position, and kind of having the legs almost perfectly right on top of each other, just off slightly, so the bones aren't causing too much pain. But then you have your left hand just on your side, and say in the right hand's underneath your, propping your head up. And Ajahn Sucitto actually recommended having a pillow underneath the head, but just enough to support it, so there's like a little less tension. And obviously the hindrance, difficulty with this posture is that any time we lie down, 99.9% of the time we lie down is to sleep. So it's drowsiness and falling asleep, you know, is the difficulty. And Ajahn Chagananda was quoting somebody, I think maybe it was Ajahn Viradamo, I can't remember, but he was saying that the one piece of advice he got that was really good about using that particular posture, the lion's posture, that really helped him a lot, was that making the determination when you go into that posture of not to move. He said that was really the key element to that. Because if you're constantly sort of making micro adjustments to feel a little more comfortable or to get away from any pain that arises, then you probably will go into, you know, really relaxation and fall asleep. So it's, you know, it's good to, you have to, I think it's really good for all of us to practice this posture, because you know, there are going to be times when we're ill, don't have the energy, and you know, if every time that we do, you know, lie down, we fall asleep, then, you know, if we are going to be in a hospital or are sick, you know, here at the monastery, you know, it will be difficult to meditate if we haven't developed that as a meditation posture. And so I think that one thing I do when I practice this is I'll set a little timer to go off in a certain period of time, like say 5 minutes or even 1 minute if my mind is really kind of drowsy, and just to, you know, so you don't fall asleep or so you don't allow yourself to go off into this real drowsy state. Well, speaking of drowsy states, I don't want Lumpur to fall asleep during one of my Dhamma talks, and I said I wasn't going to talk very long, so I think I've spoken more than I expected. So I'll leave this for our reflection this evening.
Sadhu.